Hey guys, this is BJ from American Aquarium, and you're listening to Walk the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another fine edition of Walking the Floor. I honestly don't remember where I was or what had happened when I recorded my last one of these little podcast intros, so I don't know if I'm going to repeat myself today, but let's just get into it. Okay, the big news this week, for the last week or so, my UK European solo tour dates have been on sale, and there's a whole bunch of dates. You probably listen to the tour announcement, or you can look at any of my social media. You can go to chrisshiflettmusic.com, and you can look at all the dates and buy tickets. We got Manchester, London, and Brighton are sold out. Dublin and Bristol are soon to be sold out, so if you haven't got your tickets yet, make sure you get them today. And Glasgow, Edinburgh are moving along. There's still some tickets left there. And then we hop on over to Scandinavia. There's tickets left for Oslo, for Copenhagen, and for Stockholm. But get them today. ChrisShiflettMusic.com. All the links are up there for sale, so get on it. Oh man, I have covered so much ground in these last few weeks. It's just bananas. I think I put about 11,000 miles on my new tour van, driving up and down and east and west and south and north and all over the goddamn place with the likes of Blackberry Smoke. I got to play, or I should say me and my band got to play at the Ryman out in Nashville a week or two ago. When was that? A couple weeks ago. Played the Ryman, man. Legendary. Where the Grand Ole Opry used to be, where Johnny Cash did his TV show, The Ryman. It was spectacular. I love Blackberry Smoke. I love touring with those guys. Please take us on tour again. After that, I headed out to Memphis and hooked back up with Kendall Marvel and Elizabeth Cook for like solo acoustic dates. Did another week and a half or so of those. It was awesome. Like Memphis, with the drunk sound man in Memphis who tried to destroy the show but couldn't because the crowd was just so rowdy and awesome. Atlanta, Athens, Asheville. I've never been to Asheville. So cool. Loved it. Raleigh, Maryville. I'd never been to Maryville before. Played at a Harley-Davidson dealer in Maryville, Tennessee. That was great. And then wrapped it up last weekend at the Basement East over there in Nashville, which was super, super awesome. Two shows in Nashville in a week, man. Really raising the old profile. Just kidding. Anywho, the whole thing was great. All the touring's been great. I'm heading down to South by Southwest this coming week for a bunch of gigs, tons of gigs. What am I doing? I'm doing Ray Benson's birthday party. I'm doing the Yeti Showcase. I'm doing Luck Reunion. I'm doing Paul Cawthon's Review. I'm doing something over at Arlen. And a couple other things thrown in there that I'm probably just kind of forgetting because I'm old and senile, but it's going to be a hectic week. It's going to be a great week. If you're down there schmoozing and, you know, drinking free beers or whatever it is you do at South by Southwest, try to find me and come see one of my shows. I'm also going to be podcasting from Luck Reunion, and I'm going to be doing a live podcast there in front of an audience with Shaky Graves. Alejandro Shaky Graves is going to be my guest for that at Luck Reunion, and then I've got a couple others that I think are going to happen. I might be interviewing Mavis Staples, and I might be interviewing Hayes Carl. So it's going to be a fun, jam-packed, crazy week. Then I'm going to come home and get ready to go to Europe and go boogie-woogie over there with all my European friends. Anywho, lots and lots of stuff. So make sure you get on over to chrisshiflettmusic.com and check out what's happening. Okay, let's advertise. Let's advertise. Zounds.com, the greatest website in the whole world for the working musician. There is every order over $599 and above is eligible for Zounds.com's exclusive 12 payment plan with no application process and no interest charged ever. You just pay your first monthly installment and your gear ships right away. Zounds.com. And D'Addario. Let's not forget about D'Addario because support for Walking the Floor comes from D'Addario. who is a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories. They're also committed to the sustainability through the Playback program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback program, get on over to playback.didario.com. Okay, let's get to today's interview. All right, if you're one of those people that gets a little squeamish when you hear people talk about politics, you might want to stop listening to this particular episode right now, because I think me and BJ Barham spend like maybe the first half of this interview talking about, you know, what's happening out in the world and the root causes and our particular beliefs and yada, yada, yada. So if that's going to bum you out, just press stop and go listen to some comedians on another podcast riff on, you know, pop culture, whatever kind of goofy nonsense usually happens on the internet, because that's not what this interview is all about. This is my second time interviewing BJ, and I loved my first interview. I think I love this one even more. We talk about, gosh, so many things. Sobriety, fatherhood, working with a label for the first time. We talk about Tulsa. Talk about baritone guitars. I mean, come on. We talk about how his whole band, American Aquarium, up and quit, and he had to get a whole new band, which he's done, and made a great new record called Things Change. He even plays a song from it called One Day at a Time, all the way at the end. So make sure you listen all the way through. This is my man, BJ Barham, from American Aquarium, on Walking the Floor. So I looked at the date of when I interviewed you the last time, which was almost a couple of years ago, and it was like September of 2016.
Yeah, I just put out the solo record.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You were touring your solo record. So yeah, it was in the naive pre-Trump days.
Yeah, back when there was hope and all that good stuff.
Well, but it's funny. I was thinking about it, though. I didn't go back and listen to the interview, but you were touring, like you said, your solo record. And your solo record was already really dealing with, lyrically, I mean, I don't remember if it was quite a concept record or whatever, but it's sort of dealing with what is happening in America right now with, or what has been happening actually for quite a while with the sort of deindustrialization and, you know, the jobs that everybody used to have are gone and the struggle of the working class and all that sort of thing. So
it was definitely a precursor to November
right.
of 2016,
yeah,
for sort sure.
Of, I mean, I imagine these last couple of years have given you, well, judging from your new album, it's given you quite a bit of lyrical fodder.
Yeah, it's one of those things where when I wrote that record, I wasn't necessarily writing this like pre-Trump America record. I was just writing about,
because we all thought that he was going to lose badly at
everybody
that point.
Everybody did. Yeah. I think we all live in our insular Facebook bubbles.
Yeah,
and we're surrounded by people that only echo our sentiment.
Right.
And so lucky for me, I tour in a lot of those secondary and tertiary markets in America, especially in the South. And I was telling a lot of my friends, it's like, I don't think you've seen the kind of uprising in these small towns. The middle class is what swung that election.
Right.
And so after I talked to you, I spent most of 2017 touring with the band, except for last summer, I went out for this thing called the Great 48 Tour. Hmm. And I played one show in all 48 of the lower states. It was like, well, some states got more than one. California got more than one because it's just too big. But it was 56 shows, 58 days.
Mm.
And every day I was interacting with people and talking to people and kind of casually bringing up, hey, crazy election, huh? Who'd you vote for? Why'd you vote for him?
Yeah.
Like, what made you swing that way?
Yeah.
And at first, I was like a lot of the country, and I thought that anybody that voted for Trump was just a bad person.
Right.
That was my initial, like, what were you thinking?
Right.
But then once I started talking to these people and I started asking, why'd you do it?
Yeah.
That's when it got real. That's when they said, the Bush administration did nothing for my family.
Well, okay. This is actually a quote I pulled that I really liked, because this gets right to the heart of what I think so many people are missing. And there was a quote of yours that said, if you talked to them about Trump 3 years ago, they would have told you he was a silver spoon Yankee. But their answer was, Bush didn't do anything for my family. Obama didn't do anything for my family. We're poor. We have shitty jobs. What do we have to lose?
Exactly.
And that is the thing that, to me, I mean, I'm like, it's so great to hear you say something like that, because I talk to so many people. I mean, I live in a wealthy liberal bubble
over I was going to say, Southern California is,
yeah,
you have a force field.
100%. No, no, I mean, a lot of those cliches are totally, absolutely on the money. And it's funny, over the last couple of years, especially, like, I can't tell you how many dinner parties I've ruined debating this shit with people, because I just, I can't speak to what's going on the right. I don't live in that world.
For sure.
Right? But to me, the last couple of years have turned the liberals fucking crazy. Like, I mean, they've lost their fucking minds. They can't accept that, and I say this as somebody who's way to the left of the Democratic Party in its present state. I'm not like, because I feel like when I start criticizing Democrats and liberals and that sort of thing, people always think I'm a right winger. And I'm not at all. I'm like, to the left of it, everybody, you know, I'm like a Chris Hedges progressive, you know. But I feel like this is the thing that is so many people, wealthy, professional class liberals are missing this idea that, you know, people's livelihoods have been stripped away for the last 40 years.
For sure.
And this election wasn't decided because of racism or Russia. This election was decided because of exactly what you're getting to. It's fucking desperation.
The desperation is what I took away from it.
Right.
It went from being this anger to almost this like sympathy. And like, and I know that sounds weird being from the left, being saying that I'm sympathetic to the right. But it was one of those things, when you talk to these people, it was, you know, the right cares about the rich and the left cares about the poor. What got overlooked in that 16-year of left and right was the middle class. The middle class is dying in America, mm-hmm. and they feel like they're dying. They feel like their voice is dying. That's why you saw such an uprising in 2016, was because you had what used to be the backbone of America. Like, as far as what we think about America, as far as fiscally, as far as everything, the middle class held it up. And now you have a lot of these people who are working 60 hours a week and can't get by and can't support their families.
Right.
It's not because they're lazy. It's because they're working their ass off and they have nothing to show for it. They want change. And so they were willing to take a chance on a wild card. And like I said in that interview, like 3 or 4 years ago, if you'd ask anybody, like, what do you think about Donald Trump? They're like, he's a reality television star. He's a silver spoon. You know, got born on third, think he hit a triple kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, then they were willing to put their faith in it.
Right. Well, he positioned himself as the outsider. And if you look back to basically every election for, I mean, God, going back quite a while, you know, Trump was the outsider. Obama was the outsider.
Yeah.
Bush was the outsider.
Yeah.
Clinton was the outsider. You know, that's the name of the game. I mean, Papa Bush had the Willie Horton ad stuff, you know, and ran that campaign. So he, of course, was not the outsider. But,
yeah.
But in our adult lifetimes, that's who wins these elections. Whoever can connect as the, I'm going to come into town and clean this mess up because it's not serving your interests.
Exactly.
Right.
And
that's just the marketing.
He had the best ad campaign.
Right.
And I hate to say it like that, but like Obama killed it. Obama was the first president that really got into social media and really diving into the youth vote and really actually getting the youth to vote.
Well, and then in his reelection, he had that great gift from Mitt Romney when he said there was that gaffe caught on camera, something about the 47% of society is looking for a handout. Or I forget exactly what it was, but
for
something
sure.
like that, yeah.
But like, you know, the Trump campaign, you know, it was like a lot of me and my friends live in this bubble and they were just like, there's no way he's going to do it. And I was like, you're going to be surprised. Like, it's not going to be... It's going to be a close election.
It's interesting, like kind of what you're talking about. Like, I've had some of the most interesting political conversations with like Uber drivers in the last couple of years. You know, the people that are on the shit end of the stick of the economy.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's an Uber driver because that's like their, you know.
Yeah, nobody went to school for 4 years and was like, you know what I want to do? I want to be an Uber driver.
Yeah. And that's where you get, you know, I mean, and I've met people across the political spectrum, you know, across the states while we're touring, that there's a common thread there. Like, just the system isn't fucking serving us. And for whether they identify as a conservative or identify as a progressive or whatever, there's like a common thread in there.
For sure. I've in my lifetime, you know, I'm 34. In my lifetime, I've never seen unrest like this.
Right.
Because, don't get me wrong, there's winners and losers in every election. And, you know, for 8 years, you get to poke your chest out and say, my guy won. Or you get to cower in the corner and be like, oh, the world's going to end.
But that's
I've never seen it like this, though.
That's the dangerous game right now, though, because people now, if we can call them the left, I mean, I would argue that the Democratic Party doesn't represent the true left. And I mean, the Democratic Party is a corporate right party.
Yeah.
But is now, you know, being marketed as the resistance, which is laughable. Silly.
Yeah.
And I see so many of my friends so wrapped up in the midterms and the next, you know, 2020, who are expecting, like, I don't know what they're expecting. This seems like a terrible idea that the Democratic Party has, like, squashed the vast majority of the sort of, like, progressive uprising that's been happening within it. They killed off most of those candidates in the primaries.
Yeah.
And they're running, you know, CIA veterans and...
They're just
right-wing Democrats.
Anything to beat Trump.
Anything to beat Trump. But then what do you wind up with? You wind up with a bunch of fucking CIA veterans or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not going to help. You're going to, because that might defeat Trump. That doesn't defeat Trumpism. That's the problem with that.
Exactly. I totally agree with that. It's, you know, being from the South, Trump gave a mouthpiece to some stuff that we as Southerners thought was gone.
Right.
We like to pretend it was gone. You know, the racism and kind of this underbelly of just hate.
Mm.
And, you know, we as progressive Southerners were like, oh, finally, we're past that. We're moving forward. Hell, North Carolina went blue in 2008, first time since Carter.
Really?
You know, it was like, we as a state were like, we are finally back on the map as a progressive Southern place. And then, you know, when the Trump thing came through, it was just like, all of these people that had kind of been told, you can't say that in public anymore, Grandpa, you can't say that, Dad, finally was like, well, if the guy who's running for president can say it, I can say it.
Yeah.
And he gave this mouthpiece to a lot of stuff that we as Southerners thought was dead, or at least pretended was dead. And so, like, being a Southerner now, it's like everywhere I go, people automatically assume, like, oh, you're...
Right.
We already know where you stand. And it's
right,
you don't.
It's interesting, though, because, you know, I totally agree. Like, this has emboldened some horrible fucking points of view to be spoken...
For sure.
...out loud, you know, in ways that you're absolutely right. But that's a minority of the population anywhere, isn't it?
I have to tell myself that it is. For my sake, for my kid's sake, for everybody.
Isn't a more interesting component of that election that so many people voted twice for Obama and then turned around and voted for Trump? Like, if I was king of the Democratic Party, that's the thing that I would be exploring. Well, what the fuck made that happen?
Yeah.
You can't blame that on racism.
No.
You know what I mean? That's enough to flip that election.
The whole Rust Belt, the whole stuff that... For what, 15, 20 years has been going Democrat,
right?
Switch Republican.
Yeah.
And if you look at that, it's all middle class working people.
Yeah. It's all the people that were kicked in the teeth by NAFTA.
Yeah.
That Bill Clinton passed, that Hillary Clinton brags about.
Yeah. It's
And while the election was going on, Obama was trying to get the TPP passed, you know, another big one of these crazy trade deals that's going to fuck American workers.
Yeah.
So it's like there's really no mystery to how it happened.
To
why we're here.
Yeah.
You know,
we can pretend there is, though. And that's what a lot of the left wants to do is pretend that. How did we get here? It's like, well,
we're not fucking taking care of our people, man.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
And I'm from the place that's getting hit most when we're not taking care of the American people.
Right.
You know, there's not multimillionaires living in Reidsville, North Carolina. You know, it's all working stiffs that learned a trade job, that go to work every day. Most of them aren't college educated. Hell, some of them aren't even high school educated.
Yeah.
Go and work their trade, and they work hard, and they earn a living. Well, they try to earn a living.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, sometimes it just doesn't come out at the end of the week.
Yeah.
It's I have to see it every day, and my fan base, like, especially in this style of music, anything Americana, anything based in an acoustic guitar, you know, is gonna have 50-50. You're gonna have, you know, the left that loves the songwriting and loves that you're an articulate Southerner that's coming through and saying stuff about life and your observations. But you're also going to have good old boys that relate to everything that I'm talking about.
Sure.
And so when I'm singing these songs, I'm literally singing to half the crowd I know voted left and half the crowd I know voted for Trump.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when I was writing this new record, it was all about how do I make these observations? How do I ask these questions without just downright insulting people,
right? Because
that gets nothing.
That's hard, man. It gets hard when you try to write politically.
Yeah,
to not be like, you know, pointing the finger.
You know, we live in a society that's very much fuck you, I'm right, you're wrong. Right. If you don't agree with me, fuck you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, me and my grandfather used to have these like really spirited discussions. He was very, very far right conservative, and I've always leaned extremely left. And we could sit down at the dinner table and talk on points. And then at the end of it, we'd get up, we'd hug each other, tell each other we loved each other. Respect ran through those discussions.
Yeah.
And when you take respect out of a discussion, it becomes an argument.
Right.
And that's where our country is right now. We just want to have arguments with people.
But here's the funny thing, though. Like, and most of the time when I'm out on the road, I just kind of try to avoid political discussion with people I don't know well.
For sure. You
know?
Which is a good rule of thumb.
I mean, I've been fucking touring this country for a long time, you know, in every little nook and crevice. And like, I don't walk around arguing with everybody. I don't really buy into this myth that we're so culturally divided.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that is the hoopla. It's the noise.
It's forced upon us. Yeah.
Right, you know?
There always has to be a good guy, bad guy.
Yeah.
And they make us feel like we're so much different. And that's what I tell people at shows. Like, there's some people that have called this my political record, and, and I had some people who were like, I'm never listening to you again, man. And I was like, if two of my 107 songs over the years are about touching on politics, and that's going to push you away, I was like, you were never a fan in the first place, man.
Well, it's funny. I was going to ask you about that, if you had gotten pushback from your fan base, but also pushback from the business side.
We've got some pushback from the fan base, but most of our fan base, especially the ones on the right, are like, man, I may not agree with what you're saying, but I totally support you being able to say it. And they're like, you said it in a way that didn't piss me off.
Yeah.
You said it in a way that made me try to look at it from your side.
Right. And well, your songs are stories too. You know?
Exactly. Like
Like,
I'm not coming out and being like, fuck Trump's America. I don't have a song titled that. You know, don't get me wrong, I have a song called The World Is On Fire, which is very clear where I stand. But it's also I look at this as not a political record. I look at this as just a guy who is trying to make sense of a changing world that he doesn't understand.
Yeah.
And I'm asking questions and I'm trying to get a dialogue started. And a lot of times when I go to these small towns and I play these songs, it does get dialogue started. It lets people talk to me and be like, listen, man, like, we're not all hate mongers. Like, this is why I voted the way I did. It's not based on race or anything. It's based on clear fiscal policy.
Right.
And so, you know, it gets a conversation going. And that's all I want to do. And two of the 10 songs touch on politics. The rest of them are, you know, talking about my sobriety and like an entire band quitting on me last year.
Right.
You know, it's like I had bigger fish to fry than just talking about politics.
Let's talk about that, because explain how that happened. Like, I think I might have even, I should have gone back and listened to our first interview. I feel like I might have asked you in that interview, like, is your band upset you did a solo record and you're out touring with that? I mean, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, I don't.
But was that the beginning of the end?
No, it was.
Because didn't you, am I getting this right? Did the band kind of quit en masse, and then the guys that you had been touring with for your solo thing became the band, right?
No, it was, so basically I put out the solo record summer 2016. Just because it was so different than American Aquarium stuff. It was a really stripped down record.
Yeah.
It was mostly fictional narrative. It was almost a concept record based in my hometown.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I didn't really feel like that would suit the autobiographical, chronological thing that the band had going. Because the band is kind of my, almost a journal. It's a chronological growth of me as a person.
Yeah.
Just kind of making these observations about relationships and life and the world. So I branched off, and the boys were fine with that. It just got to the point where you've been in bands, you know.
Bands are delicate.
You all start on the same page, and then as time goes by, I equate it to a tree. You're all at that base root system, and then the branches start growing out, and then you look up, and 8-9 years later, those branches are a lot further away from each other than they were when you started. It's just human nature, change.
Yeah,
and the guys that I'd been playing with for the last 8 years, we weren't on the same page anymore. There was a lot of animosity. Ego got in the way on my side and their side.
Yeah.
There was just kind of this venom running. And once that starts running through the bloodstream of the band, it's you're toast.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where music, which used to be the fuel for the day, it used to be like, all we got to do is make it to that 90 minutes and then we're good. It became the hindrance. The 90 minutes became like, that's getting in the way of my day.
Right.
And when playing music becomes like the least fun part of your day, it's time to reevaluate.
It's what a tough place for a band to be.
It's a tough place for a band to be. And so February of 2017, all the guys came to me on the same day and told me they didn't want to play music with me anymore.
Really?
And they all walked away from it.
Why didn't you go solo at that point? Why continue as
there was a huge player? That was a huge question. That was the biggest thing was, okay, maybe this is the universe telling me this is...
Well, you already
this
had is a solo album,
yeah,
too. You know?
This is my sign. Like, right. I just put a solo record out the year prior. This is your sign. And I sat down and had a long talk with my wife, and she basically said, like, as long as you're... I was the only original member. I've had 36 members since 2006.
Sure.
So these guys, don't get me wrong, they were the what people considered the definitive version of the band.
Yeah.
But they were all replacing somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
She said, this has always been your band. This has always been a mouthpiece for what you have to say. As long as you're willing to get up and sing these songs, I really feel like your fan base is going to follow it.
Have they followed it? Like, 100%. Was there any pushback from...
Don't get me wrong. People who are best friends with the bass player or best friends with the drummer probably don't come to shows anymore.
Right.
But the people that were there for the songs in the first place never once wavered.
How do you think it has changed the sound of your band?
I'm surrounded...
Because, I mean, that's like... That is the sound of the band. It's the whole band.
You have to think... I was pulling from a pool of just Raleigh, North Carolina friends who played music, which in the grand scope of things is a very small pool of the musicians in the country.
Yeah.
So I was playing with people I went to college with, people that knew somebody that I went to college with.
Yeah.
So when you're rebuilding a band, you get to go and cherry pick.
Yeah, yeah.
So three of my guys are from Texas, one of my guys is from Nashville, one of my guys is from Atlanta. I got to pull some of my favorite musicians that were kind of playing in smaller bands.
Okay.
And was like,
hey.
Like
guys that maybe you toured with here and there over the years.
Guys that I'd met through touring and been like, hey, you know, you want to come do this? Like, I've already got a pretty good thing going. Let's keep it going. And they were all on board. So we all came together and we had about a month. Last August was our first month trial run and it just clicked. It was six guys, positive energy.
Yeah.
All wanted to be there.
Yeah.
We're already fans of the songs that I'd written.
Yeah.
And then you put that up with just being, you know, shit hot musicians. And it was a no brainer.
Yeah.
After that month, it was like, okay, we're going back in the studio in December and cutting a record.
Well, it's funny, like listening to your new record, that it's such a cliche thing to think. But the first thing I thought was like, this is a mature record. Like, this is a grown up record.
Yeah. It's the first one. And like I said, I think it's, you know, it's not titled that on accident. You know, it's not called Things Change because I thought it was witty. It's very matter
of... Things really change.
Things really do change, like the entire band playing on it. But this is the first record where I really reached out of my comfort zone and didn't write just about personal relationships and the road. I wrote about a lot more of the stuff that was changing around me, like my sobriety, the band quitting, politics, impending fatherhood. And I was doing it with a completely new arsenal of musicians.
Yeah.
And so not only do we have a record that is what I would consider starting the next chapter of American Aquarium, it's also starting a next chapter of me as a songwriter.
Well, new band, new label. Too,
exactly.
Right?
New West.
Is this the first record you put out on New West?
This is the first record we've ever put out on a label.
Really?
Everything's been do-it-yourself up until then.
What led to that?
Kim Bowie was very persistent. Kim Bowie showed a lot of interest in the band, and I told her I didn't really have a lot of interest in being on a label, you know, from things I've heard from friends, and she convinced me that they could do more for me. And I was at a point in my career where I'd worked up to the point where I own all of my publishing. I own everything.
Yeah.
And so it just made sense for me. If I'm going to take a chance on seeing what a label can do, I'm in a pretty prime spot to take that chance.
That is a very different position to now. You got to talk to this department and you got to talk to that department and you got to, you know,
but I wasn't
make sure everybody's doing their thing.
Some wide-eyed kid who blindly signed at 18. And, you know, I was a 34-year-old man who had a very real concept of what the music industry was. And I knew what to ask for and what not to let get away from me.
How's that partnership going? Like, when did your record come out?
June 1st.
June 1st, okay.
Fantastic. It was the first time we'd ever seen any commercial. We've had some critical success, but it debuted at number one on the Billboard Heat Seeker charts, number three on the Americana Folk charts, Billboard, number 6 on the Billboard Country charts, number 7 on the Billboard Rock charts.
Wow.
So it was the first time we'd put out a record. It debuted in the top 10 of all 4 of those major charts. You know, that shows the muscle that a label can flex a little bit.
Yeah. Especially for a band with a rabid fan base like exactly. You've built over the years.
We've cultivated a pretty diehard foundation. And once you build that foundation, we're starting to build a pretty house on top of that thing.
Yeah.
And New West has been, I'm tickled. They've worked really hard. Radio is doing great for us.
Hmm.
We've never had any kind of success at AAA, Americana Radio. And I think we have the number 3 single on Americana Radio and the number 5 record this week.
Oh, wow.
So they're doing great.
Now you're going into those 7 a.m. Morning drive time radio interviews.
Doing a lot of phoners, doing a lot of as soon as the bus parks, you know, you're taking the an Uber over to whatever station it is and doing the 2 songs on the air kind of
thing. I'm here to play a song.
Exactly. You know, you sound like you've been gargling cement all day.
Yeah.
But it's been really, really neat.
So tell me about the actual making of the record. So who was the producer?
Producer was John Fulbright.
Okay, why do I know that name?
Like, John Fulbright was a Grammy-nominated songwriter a couple years ago. Tulsa, Oklahoma boy. One of my favorite songwriters, period. Just a brilliant, brilliant storyteller.
And you made the record down in Oklahoma.
We made it in Tulsa. Right. Yeah.
Do you think that? Do you feel like that influenced what you guys made?
Of course. It's, you know, I'm one of those guys, I don't want to make every record in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Right.
I made one record in Raleigh. Every record, I try to go somewhere different and make a record. We did a couple records ago. We recorded under Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Isbell was the producer.
Nice.
We did a record in Asheville, North Carolina with Brad Cook. So with this record, we knew we were going to do it in Tulsa or Memphis. We wanted to pick a town a lot like Muscle Shoals that used to have a vibrant musical history that maybe hasn't seen the heyday recently.
Am I right in thinking that Tulsa is where they shot Outsiders and Rumblefish?
I know that S.E. Hinton is from Tulsa.
I think that's where they shot those movies.
So I know that she wrote those books in Tulsa. And I think I might be...
That's all supposed to be Tulsa.
That is Tulsa.
Books. Yeah, yeah,
supposed to be
for
Tulsa.
Sure. Yeah.
Pony Boy.
It's all come supposed on. To be... Stay Gold.
Stay Gold. it's also... That's Tulsa.
Yeah.
And so you got to think, J.J. Cale... Leon Russell, Shelter Records.
Right.
Tulsa had a heyday in the 70s and 80s. And don't get me wrong, it's starting to have this huge resurgence because you've got John Fulbright, you got the Turnpike Troubadours, you got John Moreland, you got J.D. McPherson, Parker Millsap.
Mm.
Some of the big heavy hitters in the Americana world right now are from Tulsa.
Oh, wow.
They might live in Nashville now, but
sure,
they grew up and refined their chops in Tulsa. And so it's kind of like... What's in the water there?
Yeah.
I want to go make a record there.
Yeah.
And so we went there. We recorded this record in 8 days in Tulsa.
Songs were written before you went in? So
most of the songs were written. I wrote a couple songs in the studio, and we just kind of cut them all live on the fly.
Really?
And yeah. This record was all done, one room. We had a couple overdubs here and there.
But yeah, yeah. God, that's a great way to record.
It's man.
Love it.
I've done my last 3 records that way. And I really think it's the way to do it because you have these like beautiful imperfections that most casual listeners aren't ever going to hear.
Yeah.
But that your musician friends are like, I heard this, I heard that.
It goes in the soup, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's what makes it real. I think it's what makes it human.
Totally.
You know, because we're very much caught up in a day of a lot of people tend to err on the side of perfection. Rather than human
when
error.
When perfection entered the equation with recording, it just fucked everything up.
When you start putting drums on grids
and
you start going back and moving notes, that's not how it's supposed to be done. You're not... A guitar solo is supposed to be one dude who sits down and just rips.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got these...
Warts and all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I know that's my favorite records that I go back and listen to. You can hear those... fuck up, so you can hear him trying something completely asinine.
It's funny, man. I you know, I came up making records in the modern era as things have, you know, become computerized and perfection's been the ideal and all that stuff. And it's hard to break out of that, out of that mindset, because even, you know, my last couple records I made with Dave Cobb out in Nashville, and we just record live in a room, and then minimal, you know, there's overdubs. Well, there's quite a bit of overdubs, but like we'll be working on a part or something, And I just get into that headspace, like, fuck, I got it. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. And probably the first one you did was the best one. And, you know, it's like when you have a great producer that goes, like, you're fucking overthinking of it. Overthinking it. Stop, man.
That's why you have to pick a producer you trust, and then you have to listen to them.
Right.
And when they tell you, that was the take.
It's hard to listen sometimes.
Yeah. Because you know, we're all fragile, egotistical monsters, us artists. And we think that we can do better.
Yeah.
And sometimes you nail it on the first or second when you're not even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like when you're not overthinking, when you're just in the moment and there's a vibe, you nail it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's easy to, like, I know it's hard to walk away after the second take and be like, okay, we got it. But you have to trust that, like, the producer knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
And that they're hearing it for the first time. You're hearing it for the umpteenth time since you wrote the song.
Yeah.
So in your head, you're always chasing this radio perfection. And that's just unobtainable for most of us, especially when you're born with a voice like this. You know? You have to realize that, like, you're catching a vibe and you're not going to catch perfection.
Did I hear some baritone guitar on Work Conquers All?
You did.
Yes.
You did.
I love the baritone guitar. It's, like, for me, when I hear the baritone, that's like such an overlooked instrument in the sort of, you know, country roots.
I hope it comes back because it's one of my favorite things. It's
every time I hear it, I'm always like, oh, that guy knows what's up.
Well, a lot of all those old, like, Dwight Yoakam records.
Yes.
You know, it's exactly. All just like the baritone guitar is like,
that's the twang, man.
It makes you feel something. Yeah. Like when you hear it, you're like, that's a country song.
Totally. Exactly.
Like it's one of those instruments that, like, the minute you, it's like pedal steel guitar.
Yeah.
It's like the minute I hear that, I'm like, okay, now we're dealing with somebody that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I know what this guy, I know what's in this guy's record collection.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so that was a song that we knew had to have it. And so we had it sit, we almost put it on three or four songs, but it's one of those things you've got to be tasteful with it.
Right.
You can't just throw it on every song.
Oh, and you want to.
And you want to. Because it makes everything.
I'll play it on the whole track.
It makes everything sound so cool.
Yeah, but when it just comes in for a part, it's so powerful.
Oh, it's so definitive.
Yeah.
Like, it's if you're a musician, you hear, you know exactly what it is.
Yeah.
The minute it comes in. And on Work Conquers All, that was the song we picked for it. And it makes two appearances. It makes that initial appearance from the top, and then there's like a little solo in the middle.
Yeah.
And it's such a little nugget in the middle of that song. It makes me really happy.
There's another song that, like, sounded to me like it was like almost like outlaw country vibe. Like maybe like the countryest thing I've heard you do.
Yeah, I gave up the drinking.
I gave up drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to, I grew up listening to all those old Waylon records.
It's got that vibe.
It's got that.
That sounds like a song that's great to play live.
It's fun because it's got a clav on it. You know, there's a clavinet on that song.
Right,
you
right.
You know, so like, it's fun to kind of where funk meets.
That's where the nasty comes country. From, it's man.
Just
come on.
It's just dirty.
Yeah.
And Fulbright played the clav on that. And we still, our keys player now plays the clav live on it. And it's just, it's such a funky song. And I wanted to write this kind of classic, stereotypical honky-tonk song about sobriety.
Right.
You know, because so many
the opposite of so what they're
many
all about
are based right. in going to drink at a honky tonk.
And I'll get whiskey bent and hellbound.
Exactly. I wanted to write the antithesis of that song, but still have kind of the playfulness of that those songs have.
Yeah.
So I wanted to write in my head. I was like, what would happen if John Prine wrote a honky tonk song backed up by Waylon's band about sobriety? That's where that song. And
that's a good combo.
That's exactly what I want. Yeah, you know, and it's like, I'm sure we paled in every comparison to it, but it's like we hit what we were going for.
Right, right.
You know, I wanted to kind of write this tongue-in-cheek song about, like, yeah, it's a country song, but it's speaking against a lot of what the country norm is.
Yeah, you sure. Know, so. You guys have obviously, and you personally have built your band on years and years of hard charging touring.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are road dogs, but if you had to temper that some, you know, with becoming a dad, new members, you know, being married, all that sort of stuff.
It's you know, as you get older, you look back. You're supposed to look back and look at all your missteps, and then try to make sure that your next step forward isn't another misstep based off of what you've already done. When the first couple people quit my band back in 2006, 2007, I blamed them. after 36 people quit your band,
was it all for the same reason? We fucking toured too much.
You have to look in the mirror and say, maybe it was me.
Yeah.
And I pushed the guys way too hard. You know, there was three straight years where we did over 300 shows in a year. That's not normal.
Yeah.
Unless you're 19-year-old crusty punks who don't care.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in your 30s, you can't do that. And now my new guys are all married. My bass player's a dad. I just became a father a couple months ago. I don't want to be on the road 300 days a year.
Yeah.
After 12 years of and 3,000 plus shows, like, I've earned a break.
Yeah.
I've earned being
able home to go, is kind of nice too.
Yeah. I've earned being able to kind of take advantage of what the road has afforded me. Like, I have a house, I have a wife, I have a kid, I have a fenced in backyard. I have the American dream.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take at least half the year off from now on to enjoy that and to watch my kid grow up and to take her to all the places that I didn't get to go as a kid and to teach her what culture is and to make sure she grows up a smart Southern person who fully embraces their roots in the South, but also realizes that there's a gigantic world out there that she gets to meet one day.
Right.
As long as I don't, I refuse to raise a shithead kid. I refuse. And so part of that is being there and explaining to them about life and the world. And so my goal is to play 100 to 150 shows a year, which is still a lot of shows.
Still, that's a lot of shows.
But that lets me be home for 2/3 of the year and really focus on, you know, dance recitals or basketball games or whatever she decides that she wants to occupy her time with.
There's nothing better, you know, I have three boys. There's nothing better than when your kids, and this happens to me quite a bit now because my kids are all getting big, where they will ring you up on your shortcomings. That's when you know you did a good job.
Yeah.
You know?
I can't, Dad,
you can't say that word. No one says retarded anymore. You're like, oh, goddamn.
I can't wait to have a misstep and her correct me and be like, you are totally right, kid.
Yeah.
You know, I'm stoked on that.
That's funny, man. That's great. Well, that's a perfect place to end.
Heck yeah.
I do have one more question that I got to ask. Did you take a lot of lessons growing up? Are you more of a self-taught
dude? No, I taught myself late high school, early college. But I never sat down. Like, my guitar player sat down and watched his guitar heroes play and wanted to play those licks.
Right.
And that's what he wanted to do. He knew he wanted to be a lead guitar player and he wanted to just shred. And he was in a metal band and it was all about playing fast and as many notes, playing all the notes, all the notes.
Yeah. If you play them all, there's gotta be some right ones in there somewhere.
So for me though, I only learned how to play guitar to facilitate songwriting.
Right.
I was writing at a certain point before you learn how to play guitar. If you call yourself, you're just a shitty poet.
Right.
And I wanted to write songs. And so I realized that to do that, I was going to have to learn how to patch chords together.
Yeah.
So I learned how to play like the 7 or 8 chords that I needed to play to get through some of my favorite country songs. And then I started twisting those around and writing my own songs. And I haven't really developed much past there. I'm a pretty open chord player kind of guy. The Capo is a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
Like many songwriters that I know.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that I literally sat down. I think there was a book at the library that taught you how to play
like all your root chords,
your G, your D, your C.
Yeah.
And I just sat down and I remember reading somewhere. It's just like, it feels foreign at first, but the more you do it, the better it feels. And I remember just going from G to D, from G to D.
Yeah.
And once I mastered that and could hear it
seamlessly, throw a C in there.
I go to a C and then you learn the E minor and the A minor and throw an F in there and you're a virtuoso, you know?
Oh, man. My first guitar teacher showed me all my root chords. It's like the best thing that anybody's ever done for me.
Yeah.
So, because so many people I knew growing up just kind of learned, you know, we're heavy metal kids, just learned power chords.
Power chords.
Moving around, you know?
Yeah. It's I learned the opposite way. I didn't learn power chords until after I learned all those roots.
Right.
And
like, why didn't I just do this, man?
Yeah. It seems way easier when you can just slide up.
Yeah. Do you have like a magic guitar or something like your special guitar that's like the one?
My guitar is the one I has become synonymous with me. It's a reissue of the 68 Gibson J45, cherry red finish, white binding. 68 was the only year they did the cherry finish.
Okay.
And it was a catalog order only. So less than like 1,500 of those originals even exist.
Yeah.
So when you find, you can find one in shitty condition and it's $8,000-$9,000
Yeah, yeah.
For like a really beat up version.
Yeah.
But back in 2000, Gibson re-released 1,000 of them.
Okay.
And I picked up one of those.
Nice. So you put all the scratches on it, all the wear and tear.
I'm the only operator of that thing. It's been my road guitar since 2008, and it's that red guitar has kind of become synonymous with me. Like, people make show posters and it's got the red guitar.
Oh, right.
And people, you know, it's just an old J45.
Nice.
But it looks a little different to where it throws people off and makes them think it's something special.
Yeah,
but it's
yeah.
really just an old J45.
Nice.
That's every gig I've played since 2008. My backup's an old J180. The big Everly Brothers, but it's the Cherry.
Oh, nice.
The Cherry finished. I like the red guitars. I went to school at NC State University.
There you go.
So we were red.
You got a little Sammy Hagar in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hopefully this has a reddish hue to it. My Martin here, hopefully this will suffice. Would you like to play a song?
I'd be happy to, man.
Great.
Wide-eyed and 21, another shot of Jameson to calm my nerves before this nightly masquerade. What people saw was nonchalant, a complex conditioned response, a chemical reaction, brown liquor and self-doubt. So that I could stand up on this stage like a guilty child, avoiding blame. I'd kick, I'd scream, I'd curse the name of the girls that walked away. You see, the man left holding the pen controls how every story ends, and truth becomes a martyr for the sake of the song. Yeah, I'm in a good place. I'm a walking that straight line. I'm just getting along, righting these wrongs one day at a time. For years the drinks were just a crutch, until the drinks were just too much. I guess it comes with a job, hail, hail, rock and roll. You see, songs fulfill a human need to sit back and watch another man bleed. So for a moment we don't have to feel sorry for ourselves. This imaginary confidence became my first line of defense. If you don't let them in, boy, they'll never let you down. But she broke through and took control, my sweetheart of the rodeo. And for the first time, I found something I couldn't afford to lose. You see, I'm in a good place. I'm a walking that straight line. I'm just getting along, righting these wrongs one day at a time. Every now and then I miss the way that highball glass would kiss my lips like a long lost love welcoming me home. But I don't miss the highs and lows, the back and forth, the ebb and flow of letting down the people that are standing up for me. Yeah, I'm in a good place. I'm a-walking that straight line. I'm just getting along, righting these wrongs one day at a time. Yes, I'm getting along, righting these wrongs one day at a time.
Yeah, buddy. Fantastic.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Thanks for not making me blow the guitar out.
That was BJ Barham from American Aquarium on Walking the Floor, playing his beautiful song One Day at a Time from his latest record, Things Change. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to put some cool links up there so you can track BJ out there in the world, see where he's playing, see what he's up to, buy his t-shirts. Come on. All right, that is it for this week. I got a crazy couple weeks ahead of me, so I will probably be reporting to you from somewhere overseas next time we do this here little podcast thing. All right, boys and girls, this is Chris Shiflett signing off for now. Adios, amigos.